Hello, it's Friday, February the 5th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Another showbiz exclusive from the inimitable Baz Bamingboy. The woman who played Princess Diana in The Crown, she even looked like her, has got a big new part opposite Harry Styles. We're going to be talking about gambling. New research shows that problem gamblers that are most likely to commit suicide are very young, between the ages 24 to 35. But first, with vaccinations now hitting 3 million a week, there's more and more pressure on the government to announce a major lifting of restrictions by May. Vaccinations are now hitting 3 million per week. The government is pretty confident it may yet hit that target of 15 million by mid-February, which is, after all, next week. Boris Johnson has so far refused to set a target rate for the end of lockdown, but says he hopes to reopen schools from March the 8th. But which activities should be lifted first? With a lot of speculation, we could start coming out of lockdown by May. Joining me now to discuss this is, no stranger to this podcast, Paul Hunter, Professor in Medicine at the Norwich School of Medicine at the University of East Anglia. Professor Hunter, first of all, we have to say the rollout of the vaccine still seems to be going incredibly well. Are you worried that politicians will decide everything's okay then? We can lift out of lockdown perhaps sooner than you might have thought.
Well, I mean, it's always a difficult issue here, balancing the need to control the virus with the need to support the rest of society. And so, yes, it is a difficult decision. I think we know from our experiences in last year the downsides of being not responding quickly enough and relaxing too soon. However, I'm actually quite I am very optimistic about what's happening now with the vaccine going out and with actually the numbers of cases tumbling as we've seen and as is new hospitalizations and even deaths are starting to come down quite rapidly as well. So things are looking really good at the moment. Certainly there are, if we relax too soon before enough of our vulnerable people are protected, then yes, we run the risk of a surge. But on the other hand, we are moving into spring, and we know from coronaviruses generally, and indeed what happened to a certain extent with COVID last year, is that it's easier to control in the warmer weather as we move into the summer. And I think particularly the combination of the remaining restrictions, the warmer weather and vaccination means that I think things are going to be a lot easier this year than they were last year. And I don't see it being people talk about the end of restrictions. I can't see that happening on a day, then suddenly we'll go back to everything was like it was and everybody will be happy. It's not going to work like that. What will happen is we will undoubtedly see a gradual relaxation of restrictions over the course of weeks and possibly months, possibly some reversion back to the tier system. I think that's quite likely. And in fact, I think Chris Whitty himself has said that that was a likely thing. I mean, to me, one of the big uncertainties is the autumn and what happens if we do get a resurgence of infections in the autumn, and it's quite plausible that we do, but we will deal with that at its time, and I don't think it would be anywhere near as bad as we've had it this year following the vaccine rollout. And also, I don't think it will be our restrictions will need to be anywhere near as tough next year as they have been this year.
Do you think also there's a suggestion, one study suggesting that so many people will have had COVID by July, a large part of the country, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and also, of course, because of the rollout of the vaccine, there could be a form of herd immunity, which was the great talk which we had at the beginning of the pandemic and the talk about that was quickly dropped.
Yeah, no. Herd immunity is a false hope, really, I think. We published some work a couple of weeks ago. Warwick University modellers have done the same, that actually vaccinating a substantial proportion of the population is not going to provide herd immunity. So, and we know, particularly, we know for the Oxford vaccine, we don't know yet for the other vaccines because the work hasn't been done, but, you know, it only reduces infections by about a half, although it reduces symptomatic infections by rather more than that, and severe illness by even more. So it's not going to stop the disease spreading. And people who are vulnerable but have not had the vaccine will remain vulnerable if they've not had natural infection. So we will continue to see some illnesses in these groups, and how as a society we manage that to protect those, I think we need to be thinking about. It's likely that at some point, as case numbers drop, we might actually start seeing a difference in the way that the disease spreads, in that it will get localized clusters, and we'll have to have mechanisms in place to deal with those localized clusters while they're still small enough to actually control them. But that aside, things are, I think, looking a lot better now than they did, providing that we sort of manage the next month or so and enable the recent decline to continue so.
All right, that's Paul Hunter. He's an epidemiologist and he's professor in medicine at the Norwich School of Medicine at the University of East Anglia. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Daily Show free and in full. And, of course, you can catch up with our other podcasts and video series. New research shows problem gamblers are more likely to die young, with gamblers who spend a large amount a third more likely to die within 5 years. This research has been done by Oxford University. It found that more than 500,000 Britons are spending £900 a month on their habit, and get this, 200,000 paying out more than 1,800. Joining me to discuss this is Charles Ritchie from Gambling with Lives. Mr. Ritchie, these figures are truly shocking. 200,000 people paying out more than £1,800 a month. Even if they were earning a lot of money, that is an unsustainable financial loss, surely.
Yeah, I think, in fact, the numbers probably refer to deposits made rather than necessary losses.
Okay.
But yeah, there are some extraordinarily high figures in there. And I think what the figures do show is this massive skew in the amount of money that people gamble. Most people actually gamble a fairly small amount, but there are a significant number who do spend an extraordinary amount.
The research shows that a gambler who spends 30% of their income on however they're playing it, whether it's cards or gambling on football or horses, is a third more likely to die within 5 years than a non-gambler. What sort of age group are we talking about here?
Well, I know that there are gambling suicides across the age range, but the experience of Gambling with Lives is that it definitely does tend to be younger people. Amongst the Gambling with Lives families who've lost people to gambling-related suicides, the majority are really aged probably between about 24 and 35. There are some who are younger than that, and there are some who are older than that. But it's something that, you know, does affect young people.
24 to 35. I mean, if you're 24, you've barely lived your life, which is really, really disturbing. What sort of debts, on average, are they running up by the time they've taken the terrible decision to end it all?
Well, I think that's one of the things that we need to challenge. And actually, I think that this research shows that we're not necessarily talking about people who have run up debts of tens or hundreds of thousands of pounds. Our own son, Jack, who died age 24 and he'd been gambling for 7 years, he died 3 years ago. And Jack actually died with an overdraft of £1,500 and an outstanding loan of £2,000. So Jack did not have massive debts. There are a large number of the families, actually, where the person who has died was not significantly in debt. I mean, occasionally, yes, there have been people who've had tens of thousands of pounds in debt, but the vast majority are not significantly in debt. And I think that's really one of the things that we need to challenge about, you know, that gambling is only affecting people who have lost massive amounts of money. You know, it's a mental health condition. It's a proper addiction. It's a mental health disorder.
And in your view, if you don't mind me dwelling on your son Jack, and obviously my commiserations to you, my condolences to you to lose a son so young, had he shielded his debt from you and from his family?
We knew that Jack was gambling. I think we never understood just how gambling is a real addiction, and what it does is it undermines your total sense of self, and it makes you feel as if you are the worst person in the world. This is the model that the industry promotes, of this idea of responsible gambling, and that you should be able to cope, you should just be able to stop. It's all about a focus on the individual. That is just meaningless once you're talking about a proper addiction. So Jack, as I say, didn't run up massive debts. You know, one of the things about Jack was that in many respects he was the model of this so-called responsible gambler. You know, he gambled largely from within his own means. I mean, obviously it meant he didn't have money to spend on clothing or holidays or the things that you'd expect a young person to do, but it wasn't as if he was running up massive debts. You know, Jack was being responsible in that respect.
And how was he, if you don't mind me dwelling on this again, what lured him into it? What was he gambling on?
Yeah, well, Jack started, as so many people do, started as a child. I mean, Jack actually started gambling when he was 16, 17, strictly illegal. He used to gamble on the fixed odds betting terminals with a bunch of schoolmates in their lunch hour, basically gambling, you know, £2 their lunch money. Jack was the unfortunate one. He actually had two very big wins within a very short period of time. So as a 17-year-old schoolboy, he went to school with £2 in his pocket and came back with £1,000. Now, obviously, we didn't know that he was even gambling at all at that stage, and we didn't actually find out for about a year when he told us what had happened, and he'd lost probably about £3,000 or £4,000 that his grandmother had given him as well. And by that stage, we now see that Jack had a deep and serious addiction. I don't think we understood it. I mean, I think we still saw this is a young man growing up, pushing the boundaries. You know, that we were fooled, as the rest of the world is, that this is a fun activity, just a bit of fun, do something to do with your mates. It's not, you know. Things like the fixed odd betting terminals, and you now have exactly the same products available online in your pocket.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And they are incredibly addictive. You have addiction and at-risk rates for some of those products of 50%. You know, so you're more likely than not to actually end up harmed by them.
And just this week, the Gambling Commission was heavily criticised. You will know that, Mr. Ritchie, because it could have done more about to restrict the amount of money that can be waged online, but they didn't do it. And I spoke to the chairman of one of the common select committees that's looked into gambling, and she said the Gambling Commission isn't fit for purpose. But moving that aside, as a parent of somebody who died, took his own life because of gambling addiction, what do you want the government or the authorities to do, or the regulator to do, to ensure there aren't more Jacks?
I think there's a lot of things that need to happen, and obviously we've got the review of the Gambling Act underway at the moment. I mean, I think that the core for us is that gambling needs to be effectively enshrined in law as a public health issue. It cannot be kind of a range of piecemeal legislation and activities about, you know, reducing a stake here or whatever. We've actually got to see this as the public health issue that it is. So we actually do need, you know, number one, to be honest, for us is actually having clear and open information about just how dangerous gambling is. When Jack started on fixed odds betting terminals, he was, as far as he was aware, engaging in a fun activity. You know, that it's He and we knew about drugs. We knew about issues of alcohol. People know that heroin is a deeply serious drug and that it is different to cannabis. You have no idea when you start gambling just what danger you're entering into. So actually that is number one on our list, really, is that classification and licensing on gambling products based on their addictiveness and potential for harm. I mean, I do think the Gambling Commission did do some good things this week, that they have introduced some changes to products and games, limiting the speed at which they can play. But they're still incredibly fast games. I mean, a spin speed of 2.5 seconds, to me, is not a slow game. I think there are a range of other things. There's a lot of debate around affordability limits at the moment. If Jack had been subject to an affordability check when he was a schoolboy, again when he was a student, and again when he was starting his first job, Jack would have been picked up as saying, you cannot afford to be gambling at this level. And then we do need a whole side of change on treatment as well. I think it's something like 2% of problem gamblers receive any form of treatment, and the vast majority of that is outside the NHS. We do need a comprehensive and integrated NHS prevention and treatment programme.
All right, that's Charles Ritchie, who's from Gambling With Lives, which is a charity that supports the families of those who committed suicide due to gambling. And yet again, if you will accept our profound regret and commiserations over the death of your son, Jack.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Really nice to talk to you. At last, Britain's hotel quarantine scheme, they've been talking about it for months, it seems, will finally begin on February the 15th. Weeks after it was first announced, sources are suggesting the government's racing to reserve 28,000 hotel rooms across the UK to launch the scheme. But as 20,000 people come into Britain most days at our airports, it's nothing like enough, is it? Joining me now is Mark Palmer, who's the Daily Mail's travel editor. Mark, just very briefly on that, the head of Best British Hotels?
Best Western.
Best Western, pretty astonishing, admitted on the radio the other day, nobody from the government had bothered to talk to him about how to deploy hotels for quarantine, even though his company has hotels in Australia and New Zealand where they've been doing this for the best part of a year.
Yes, and I think the answer to that, Andrew, is that the government doesn't really know what it wants and hasn't worked out yet all the logistics, I'm afraid. And the questions keep coming. Hotels who want to help, want to open up, but they want to know who's actually going to pay for the security, who's going to pay for the food, what's going to happen if someone does try to break out and escape. So I think that the government actually has been wanting in a way to kind of push this to the side, hoping that the vaccines speed up so much that actually it doesn't have to be enacted at all.
Yeah. So that's going to be a problem for the government. It's going to be a problem for anybody coming back because they'll have to check into a hotel. Those lovely hotels all around the airports, a mere £1,500 or so. But there's a bright spot, isn't there, Mark Palmer, for people who are desperate for a bit of summer sun.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the good news is that that British tourists could well be welcomed to Greece as early as May, provided they've got proof that they've had both their COVID-19 jabs. And the Greek authorities, they are obviously desperate because tourism it amounts to, I think it accounts for a fifth of the country's GDP. 2 million of us go to the Greek islands every year. The only other country that actually surpasses that is Germany. But the Greek tourist minister made a point of saying that that Germany is so far behind the UK when it comes to its vaccination program that we're going to have the beaches to ourselves.
How lovely. So we won't have to compete with those irritating German tourists putting their towels on the sunbeds at six in the morning.
Well, no, that's right. And they're taking quite a dim view of the Russian vaccine program as well, and so they're hinting that the Russians won't be welcome.
Another
in
win,
this summer.
Another win, really. So will this be the Greek islands, Mark, or will it be the Greek mainland?
No,
or just
I think it'll be both. I think it'll be mainland and Greece. And I mean, there are people who think that there's an issue with quarantine passports, vaccine passports. But I think that as a short-term measure, if it's going to give us a chance to get out, and particularly if by the end of March, all over 50s will have received their vaccines.
That's well, me and you, Mark.
Well, exactly. Then off we go, Andrew.
Yeah. So we could go to the Greek islands, which would be lovely. And we know the government say there's not going to be a COVID passport, but I know for a fact they are working behind the scenes. They are looking at it. And at some point, a prototype will be wheeled out. And I can't see what the problem is.
No. And I think James Cleverly today on the radio,
that's the Foreign Office Minister. Yeah.
But he sort of tied himself up in knots, really. And I don't see why we can't just say, well, yes, we're talking to the Greek authorities, we're planning this, and it could save our summer.
So which Greek island are we off to, Mark? Are we going to Paros? Are we going to Mykonos, Santorini,
Crete? I know that your favourite is that funny one with the windmills. What's that one?
Mykonos, too expensive
Mykonos,
now.
I've always loved Corfu, have to say, and I've always longed to go to Hydra, where Leonard Cohen had a house for a long time.
Is that where he got inspiration for his very depressing music?
It absolutely was. I don't find it depressing at all, so I can't wait to go there and turn up the volume on Leonard Cohen.
And his very depressing poems.
Lovely, lovely poem. Deeply, really make us all think deeply about our lives, Andrew. And we can enjoy our sunshine once more in Greece.
And just finally, Mark, it's just going to be great for people listening to this to hang on to the fact, we could be going abroad in the summer. Because we want good news where it is.
Yeah, it's funny, Andrew, because every Saturday morning when I get up, I kind of think to myself, are we in a better position than we were seven days ago? And last Saturday, it was all a little bit grim. We had the row with the EU. We didn't quite know whether the vaccine was going to work with these new strains. Honestly, today, Friday, and so coming into this weekend, I'm feeling a lot more optimistic on various fronts.
And I'll even drink a glass of ouzo when I get to the Greek island to celebrate the fact, because it's absolutely horrible.
Well, I'll join you.
Sounds great. That's Mark Palmer, who is the Daily Mail's award-winning travel editor. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. It's that time of the podcast. Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls is with me. Now, is Jose Mourinho not quite so special after the football with Chelsea last night, Tim?
Jose's not special anymore.
Right, I never thought he was.
Well, he certainly thought he was. Yeah. And, you know, his track record at Porto, at Chelsea, at Real Madrid, Inter Milan, absolutely superb, one of the best managers in the world. Things started to sort of unravel a little bit at Manchester United, his previous job. He had a year out of the game before taking over at Tottenham. He looked refreshed, he looked raring to go. He's been backed in the transfer market. Earlier in this season, it looked like he'd refound his mojo. Spurs were riding high. They went top of the league when they beat Arsenal 10 games ago, and things were looking good, you know, and he has taken them to the League Cup final, which is in April, which is obviously deserves credit for. But in terms of their league form, it's 2 wins in 10 since then.
God,
they've slipped down to 8th in the league. They're 14 points behind Manchester City, who are at the top. They're 7 points behind Liverpool, who are 4th. The football's not very entertaining, which is something that Tottenham and their fans have always sort of demanded. It's always been an expectation. They're not a club who wins many trophies, or certainly not over the last 20, 30 years. But the style of play has always been important to the club. The football that Mourinho is producing at the moment really isn't very very attractive to watch. They've now lost 3 games in a row in the league. They play West Brom on Sunday, who are right down at the bottom, fighting for their lives. That is a really important game for Mourinho, because after that, they've got the FA Cup against Everton, then they play Man City, and then they play West Ham. It's a really tricky run of games. They could be completely out of sight in terms of race for the top four, which brings Champions League football and vital revenue at a difficult time for football. You know, let's see what he's made of. But it's been a difficult year for him at Tottenham. He's not really shown the kind of ability that he showed certainly at Chelsea, Real Madrid, Inter Milan, Porto, all those clubs where he enjoyed so much success. Things are, you know, he's not at a club that can outbid all their rivals. He's not at one of the biggest clubs. He's at a club that's got some very good players, are ambitious, and it's not really working. And, you know, if it carries on like this, the owner is going to have a decision to make.
Very interesting. And cricket is back on Channel 4. So that means, Tim, the test matches, anyone will be able to watch them.
They can, yeah.
So that's good news for cricket fans.
It's brilliant for cricket fans that it's on Channel 4. And Channel 4 do a very good job. And, I mean, they've not had any cricket since the 2005 Ashes. But amidst all this, before we get on to what happened in Chennai today, I just, Sky have been brilliant for cricket in this country. I understand the argument of having cricket on terrestrial TV, and it is vital that that kids and cricket fans of all ages get to see the England cricket team play. But you know, there's been a sort of a bit of a narrative over the last sort of few days about how great it is that Channel 4 have got it. And it is great. But let's not forget that Sky have been a great supporter of English cricket. Their coverage is superb. And no one else was bidding for England cricket rights. So, you know, while Channel, it's great it's back on terrestrial TV. It's great that Channel 4 have got it. And, they, you know, from today's coverage, it was very, very good, polished as you'd expect. But, you know, I just wanted to mention Sky because I do think they've done a fantastic job with English cricket over the years. And, you know, why can't we have the best of both worlds? That would be, it's not one or the other. It'd be lovely if terrestrial TV showed a bit more interest in cricket and actually bid for the rights more regularly. But anyway, in terms of the actual action, Andrew, which I know you're desperate to get
hanging on every word.
You are. England, 236 for three, a really good day. But the main man, once again, Captain Joe Root, what a man he is. Three tons in three tests now.
Another century, really.
Another century in his 100th test for England. He's going to go down as one of the all-time greats. He's 128 not out at the moment. England are in a good position at 236 for three, but in India, you need to rack up the runs. So it was a real blow losing Sibley in the last over of the day. He fell for 87. It'll be a really important morning session tomorrow for England. We've seen before in India, you really need to go big in that first innings to put yourself in a position to win the test match. It's going to be a really hard series. We've got three more tests after this. It'd be great if England could get off to a winning start.
Great stuff. That is, of course, Tim Nichols, deputy editor of the newspaper. Well, you can.
I've been promoted.
Like. Yeah, why not? Why not? He's the deputy sports editor, of course. Thanks for joining us. So if you've been watching The Crown, and I've gone off it a bit because I hated the way Gillian Anderson played Mrs. Thatcher, you will know that the actress who played Princess Diana, Emma Corrin, has had much critical acclaim, not least because she looks so much like the late Princess. Well, she's now won a coveted role opposite pop idol turned actor Harry Styles in her first major film. How do we know this? Of course, it's in Baz Bammy Boy's amazing column in the Daily Mail today. Another great scoop. And Baz joins me now.
Hi, Andrew.
I love the fact, Baz, you say they're going to play a young couple who become caught up in a polysexual menage a trois. Now, look, what does polysexual mean? Because call me old-fashioned. Call me old-fashioned. You're heterosexual, you're homosexual, you're a lesbian. Bisexual, that's your lot.
It's when they all meet in the middle, as it were. Well, look, the role that Harry's playing is Tom. He's the policeman of the title. And there's an art culture guy who's besotted with him. But, of course, then so is Emma Corrin's Marion. And so they do have this menage a trois. I don't want to give too much away.
I get that. It's fascinating, though, Baz, because I see it's being directed by Michael Grandage. Now, I know him from the theatre, don't I?
Yes. He's an accomplished theatre director, we know. But he did do a movie a couple of years ago called Genius with Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman and Laura Linney. And so this is his second outing, as it were, as a film director. And I've got to tell you, Andrew, I mean, we were talking before this about It's a Sin. I think what's happened during the pandemic is that everyone's been glued to their TV. They've watched more stuff than they ordinarily would. So I think dangerous topics, as it were, are okay. People want to watch stuff that challenges them. And I think this will, if they get it right.
Yeah, it's a big leap for her, according to your piece, Baz, because she's been nominated for a Golden Globe for her portrayal of Di in The Crown's fourth series, but this is her first major film role. Do you think it's going to be a big smash hit? And is Harry Styles well known beyond British soil? I wouldn't know.
Oh, yes. He's over in Los Angeles making a movie now with Olivia Wilde, who's directing him on the set and in bed, from what I gather.
Oh.
Harry is learning his way around the film set, Andrew. But Emma Corrin, she's the real deal. Underneath all that shy guy nonsense in The Crown, she's acting. It's not an impersonation. And I tell you, those co-stars, Olivia Colman, Helena Bonham Carter, and Gillian Anderson, who I know you don't like in The Crown, I tell you, if Emma wasn't acting properly, they would have been down on her. But she delivered.
Absolutely. While I've got you, Baz, we've had the Golden Globe nominations. The Crown seems to be able to do no wrong. Were you surprised to see quite so many nominations, including Gillian Anderson? Because, I mean, you know I'm a great fan of Margaret Thatcher, and I thought her portrayal of Thatcher was completely ghastly. The voice was over-accented. She walked with a stoop, and Mrs. Thatcher didn't, and she looked 100.
Yes, it wasn't quite the portrayal that we were hoping, but at the same time, they didn't want to make it a documentary. But
no, I get that.
I thought she was the sort of the weakest link, I think.
That's interesting.
But you know, they're gearing up for Crown season 5. They're going to start shooting that in a few months.
Amazing, isn't it? And Baz, is there any sign of life? I mean, what's happening in the film world with COVID? Are they managing to film now socially distanced, or are they, because of course very difficult in Britain because of the lockdown here, but the United States, it's more relaxed in certain states, of course.
Well, they are allowed to audition, to rehearse and to film, but you know, the safety protocols are enormous. And actually, not to give too much away, I'm wondering what's going to happen in My Policeman with some of the intimate scenes. I'm not quite sure how they're going to do that, whether they're going to do it with sort of a commuter, do it via computer or something. I'm not quite sure if a kiss will be a kiss, or making love will be really making love.
Harry Styles can't have sex. He's a child. He's a teen idol. They don't have sex.
Well, I tell you, he's the guy that both Emma Corrin's character and the other character obsess over, so...
Right, right.
Got to have something. And he looks kind of interesting in his twin set and pearls, and I don't know, I'm not quite sure what that's all about.
Yeah, I saw a photograph of that. And just finally, Baz, is he a good actor?
Yes, but he's only been tested in Dunkirk, and...
Yeah, it's quite...
He had some top, you know, sort of A-list character actors surrounding him. Whether he can carry a movie of this type, I don't know. We'll see. But Michael's a good director. Michael's good with actors.
It was almost a cameo in Dunkirk, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, sort of. But I don't think he was cast just for his name, because, I mean, they didn't need a name in Dunkirk, really. But I think it was his face. I mean, those people from the 40s and 50s, if you look back at photographs, and I've been looking at photographs of you too, but they looked older back then, I think.
They did.
Young
they
people
did.
Looked older, didn't they? And he's got an old-fashioned face.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems a great film. And Baz, the Golden Globes. When do we get those? When are they being announced? The winners?
Well, it's going to be in March. But of course, all the dates are all over the place. I mean, the Oscars are in April. I mean, it's awards season, and everyone's doing it from their homes. You know, it's not the awards season that we know and love.
Will this be your first Golden Globes? Not actually there.
This is the first time in 30-odd years that I've missed the Golden Globes.
Amazing. But you see them from a beautiful home county in England, so it's not all bad.
No, I'm going to watch movies, but I mean, listen, I'm very lucky and privileged, and I can do my job, but I kind of feel sorry for the people who aren't in my situation.
Absolutely. It's another scoop for Baz Rammanbore. You get some every week. Emma Corrin, she is Princess Diana in that latest season of The Crown, opposite... pop idol turned out to Harry Styles. It's called My Policeman, and it involves a polysexual menage a trois. And now I know what polysexual means. So I've learned a lot from Baz, as usual. Always good to talk to you, Baz. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, and good night.